Thank you, Larry, and thank you, Sarah, for that number. And thank you for not singing. I take you to the book of Judges one more time this morning as I bring to a conclusion this little series we've been doing on Gideon. And we'll see today, again, about God's work through human weakness. Back in 1996, two military strategists, Harlan Ulliman and James Wade, began advocating for a more focused approach to warfare. They argued that engaging the enemy with an overwhelming show of force will destroy, quote, the adversary's will to resist before, during, and after battle. The title of the book they wrote was called Shock and Awe. You may remember that as the name of one of the warfare approaches that our U.S. military took in the Middle East a few years ago. But the strategy, according to these two individuals, was to paralyze the enemy's perception of the battlefield and destroy its will to fight. And the goal really was to render the opponent impotent by using superior technology, precision engagement, and information dominance. And before the first Iraqi war, Ulliman predicted that within 2 to 5 days, the enemy will be physically, emotionally, and psychologically exhausted. Well, in Judges chapter 6, where we have been the last two Sundays, as you recall, the Midianites had been troubling the Israelites for 7 long years, invading their country at harvest time, stealing all their grain, trampling down everything else, while the Israelites ran to the hills and hid until it was over, and then they came back and struggled through the rest of the winter trying to survive. Well, in chapter 7, the tables are going to be turned now, and God will use Gideon and a little band of soldiers, we'll call that in parentheses, but he was going to use them to pull off a very unique kind of shock and awe that would send the Midianites into a self-destructive panic. So there are 3 lessons that I'd like to draw from the text in the time that we have left here. The first lesson is the fact that God does his best work through the weakest people. Now, that seems the opposite of what we would think it would be, but that's the way God works. Now, Gideon had given the trumpet call toward the end of chapter 6, remember? And 32,000 men from the surrounding tribes of Israel responded for this battle, which was great, except for the fact that there were 135,000 enemy soldiers they had to go up against. But we come in the first 3 verses of chapter 7, and we see the first shrinking of Gideon's army. At verse 1, then Jerubbaal, that is Gideon, and all the people who were with him rose early and camped beside the spring of Herod, and the camp of Midian was on the north side of them by the hill of Morah in the valley. The Lord said to Gideon, the people who are with you are too many for me to give Midian into your hands, into their hands, rather. For Israel would become boastful, saying, my own power has delivered me. Now therefore, come, proclaim in the hearing of the people, saying, whoever is afraid and trembling, let him return and depart from Mount Gilead. So 22,000 people returned, but 10,000 remained. Now this whole releasing those who were afraid goes back to Deuteronomy chapter 20, verse 8, where God told his people regarding the laws of warfare. He said in that verse, then the officer shall speak further to the people and say, who is the man that is afraid and faint-hearted? Let him depart and return to his house so that he might not make his brother's hearts melt like his. So it was a wise strategy. Let those who are afraid or cowardly, let them go, lest they contaminate the rest of the troops and they become just as fearful as they are. But I think Gideon was a little surprised that 22,000 out of his 32,000 headed for the hills, leaving Gideon with only 10,000 men. Yet before Gideon can even catch his breath over that, verse 4, God comes to him and says, "You've still got too many." Now notice verse 4, "Then the Lord said to Gideon, 'The people are still too many. Bring them down to the water, and I will test them for you there.'" Now, it's kind of strange because I would think maybe Gideon might have argued with the Lord a little bit here, you know? Wait, what? I'm reduced to 10,000, and you want more to be thinned out? You do the math, Lord, here. Me going up against 135,000, this isn't going to work. But there's no statement recorded here that Gideon gave any argument. Maybe God didn't give him time to respond. But I think the reason Gideon didn't say anything is because the Lord had already explained in verse 2 what was going to happen if they had too many. Israel would become boastful, saying, "My own power has delivered me." So God's going to make sure that they know that this is something God's going to do, and they're not going to take any credit for it. And Gideon, I think, had already learned by now, when God says he's going to do something, let him do it. Don't argue. So that brings us then to this second reduction in verses 4 through 8. Let me pick it up at verse 5. "So he brought the people down to the water, and the Lord said to Gideon, 'You shall separate everyone who laps the water with his tongue as a dog laps, as well as everyone who kneels to drink.' Now the number of those who lapped, putting their hand to their mouth, was 300 men, but all the rest of the people kneeled to drink water. The Lord said to Gideon, 'I will deliver you with the 300 men who lapped, and will give the Midianites into your hands, so let all the other people go, each man to his own tent.'" So the 300 men took the people's provisions and their trumpets into their hands, and Gideon sent all the other men of Israel, each to his own tent, but retained the 300 men. So let me just suggest here, there's a bit of ambiguity in this narrative about the drinking of the water. As the men drank, Gideon, well, actually God would do the separating, but be separating those who apparently would lap the water with their tongues like a dog from those who would kneel and drink. Now, that sounds pretty clear until you keep reading on. There becomes a little confusion here regarding which men were the ones who were actually chosen and why. Now, I've always taught it a certain way, and I'm thinking differently now. After I have read and reread that thing a dozen times and in different translations and consulted other sources, nobody seems to really say for certain which group of men it was. Some writers suggest that the kneelers were the ones who knelt down and scooped the water up into their hands and holding on to their weapon in the other hand. That's what I've always taught, you know, that they were like this and holding their weapon and they're bringing the water up in their hands to stay alert. Well, the others were ones who got down on all fours and stuck their face in the water and lapped like a dog. But the text doesn't specifically say that. The indication is that those who knelt and lapped like a dog were the 300 men who were chosen for battle. Now, whatever the explanation is, and I don't have time to go into detail and try to figure this all out, but whatever the explanation is, we do know that it was a test that God was giving to separate the men. Now, it may have been he's separating the most watchful from those who were the most negligent. And again, that's what I've always taught, that he chose the men who knelt down and took the water to their hands so they could keep alert for the enemy. So they were the most watchful. But there are others who are very credible, including historian Josephus, who says that it was actually those who were less watchful that were chosen, the ones who lapped like a dog. Now, bear in mind, I've always had in my head that this was like a creek stream flowing, but according to verse 1, it's a spring, the spring of Herod. So I don't know if this is coming from a rock and they're standing up or what the deal is. But By taking those who were less watchful, it would further weaken Gideon's army, which would naturally result in greater dependence upon God's power. Isn't that what God was trying to do in the first place? So let's go with that one for now, okay? Regardless of what I've preached before, or you've heard, or what you think this is about, let's just go with that theory that he took the less watchful ones. And the purpose would be to show that the victory would be entirely by the power of God, not by man at all. And that certainly makes sense. He's already reduced Gideon's army to 300 men, so it just makes sense that instead of giving Gideon the skilled and alert troops, he'd actually leave him with 300 nerds, really, to go into battle with. So instead of having a bunch of soldiers that were like Rambo, he would have a group of guys that are more like Gomer Pyle or Forrest Gump, guys who would probably be more apt to stumble over their own swords once they got into battle. But you'll notice in a moment, they didn't have swords. So, remember, I referred to this verse before. The Apostle Paul said in 1 Corinthians chapter 1 that God has chosen the weak things of this world to shame the things that are strong. So it just makes sense that God would weaken Gideon's army to the lowest point possible, because these men are actually not going to be doing much of anything by way of fighting. So it comes down to the fact that our second lesson, and that is that God chooses the strategy and we follow his orders. That's the way it always works. You try to do it the other way, where we figure out the strategy and give it to God and say, here, bless this, I'm going with it. Never works. So the Israelites now are outnumbered 450-1. And I think God knew that Gideon still had some fear in his heart. He's not showing it. He's not indicating it. He's not asking for signs anymore. But I think God knows that in his heart there's some anxious thoughts, some anxiety. Well, you would have them. I would have them, wouldn't you? Even though you're trusting God, there's still some fear. That's normal. Gideon wasn't the only guy in the Bible who had an issue wrestling with fear and anxiety. Pretty much all the giants did. Moses and Joshua, David, Elijah, Peter, all the disciples, they all struggled with fear. In fact, the single most common command in the Bible is fear not. Don't be afraid. Because God says, I am with you. So let's have fun with this. If you would just repeat this after me. I don't have to be afraid. Say that. Because God is with me. That's closing prayer and go home. Nope, I got 15 minutes to kill. Well, see, God doesn't want us to handle things on our own. So what he does is God comes along and he actually is going to give Gideon some encouragement. So this encouragement we find in verses 9 through 14, and the first one just comes in a restatement of his original promise. Verse 9, now the same night that he separated the troops, it came about that the Lord said to him, arise, go down against the camp, for I have given it into your hands. Now pause at that last sentence. Notice God did not say, I will give it into your hands. He said, I have given it into your hands. God is speaking in the past tense, as if this thing's already done. So Gideon doesn't have to go down there hoping God gives the victory. I hope God comes through like he said he is. No, I've already given them into your hands, Gideon. Now when he's telling him here to go down to the camp, this isn't the invasion. This is a little spy mission that he's sending him on. And so God even says at verse 10, but if you are afraid to go down, go with Purah, your servant, down to the camp. So two of you go. Sneak into the camp. do a little spy mission. Now, there's something that happens when he gets there. It sounds to me like he and his servant are on the outskirts of the camp. They're really close, but they're outside of one of the tents. And it's at that point that God gives him a sign. Slide down to verse 13. When Gideon came, behold, a man was relating a dream to his friend. So just picture these two guys inside their tent. Gideon and his servant are outside the tent overhearing this. And he said, behold, I had a dream. A loaf of barley bread was tumbling into the camp of Midian, and it came to the tent and struck it so that it fell and turned it upside down so that the tent lay flat. His friend replied, this is nothing less than the sword of Gideon, the son of Joash, a man of Israel. God has given Midian and all the camp into his hands. Well, that's pretty good reassurance. The Lord is actually taking the promise he gave to Gideon and letting him hear it from the lips of the enemy. Now, this fact that it's a barley loaf, I don't think we need to skip over that fact. Barley was a grain that was primarily used by poor people. That's why the Midianites would come into Israel and steal their wheat, not their barley. Wheat was the good stuff. The barley was filler, I guess. But the barley loaf, then, in this dream, would represent or serve as an image of the weakness and humiliation of Gideon and his army. They're just poor, weak people. That's what it is. But, you know, Gideon really didn't mind being compared to a loaf of stale barley bread because he knew that in that dream it was symbolic of Israel's defeat over the Midianites and the deliverance of his people from their oppression. So once Gideon hears that, the next thing that takes place is Gideon's worship. Verse 15. When Gideon heard the account of the dream and its interpretation, he bowed in worship. He returned to the camp of Israel and said, arise, for the Lord has given the camp of the Midian into our hands. Now, what I find fascinating here is Gideon's worship apparently takes place right there on the spot outside that tent. Now, I don't think he sang any worship songs or did anything like that, but it was just a quiet worship of God because he's hearing this reaffirmation that God has given him through the lips of the enemy. And he's overwhelmed by the Lord's goodness and mercy. And he falls on his face right there at the edge of the camp. And he's in submission and deep gratitude to God for what he's given him. Joshua did the same thing before taking the city of Jericho. Worship. That's good for us to do. Anytime. We don't have to be in an organized place with instruments and music and everything else that goes on, as wonderful as these things can be. It's that private worship that really means the most. Those are the times that God strengthens us. I like what Warren Wiersbe said. He said, before we can be successful warriors, we must first become sincere worshipers. So that we can improve our private worship. That's going to be a bigger help than the most hip worship service you could be a part of. Well, the next thing that takes place is we see some evidence of God's wisdom in verses 16 through 18. I'm not going to take time to read the text, but this is actually wisdom that came to Gideon from God. But the plan was simple and effective. Gideon gave each of his men a trumpet to blow, a jar to break, and a torch to burn. No swords are mentioned here. No weapons. Just those three things. A trumpet, a jar, and a torch. And the plan is to go at night. We're told in verse 19 that it's the middle watch, which would be about 10:30 at night. They would go in and circle the camp in the darkness, probably in the woods, with the torches hidden under the jars. And the trumpets that they had were not brass instruments. They were ram's horns called a shofar. And it would make that weird sound, you know, something like that. I didn't practice my shofar, but I do a better trumpet. But same instrument that Gideon used when they went around the city of Jericho. But Gideon was to divide those 300 men into three companies of 100 each and be positioned strategically all around the camp. And then at Gideon's command, they would break the jars, expose the lights, blow the horns, shout a sword for the Lord and for Gideon, and it would throw the enemy into just a steep panic. I'll come to that in just a moment. But that's the plan. But one thing I want you to notice before I go further with that is how Gideon has changed. He's now the example to follow. And he tells the men in verse 17, watch me. Follow my lead. Do exactly as I do. Gideon has come a long way from that guy cowering in fear down there at the wine press, grinding out little bits of wheat, hiding from the enemy, and ready to run if they come. Long way from asking God the questions, why? Why has God let this happen to us? Where is God? No longer is he asking for a sign. Instead, he is confidently giving orders to his men, knowing that the Lord has given them the victory before they've even left their camp. That's the wonder of the gospel. The wonder is we don't have to stay who we are. If we're weak, if we're shallow in our faith, if we feel powerless, if we're scared, we don't have to stay that way. Through faith in Jesus Christ, anybody can change. As Paul stated in 2 Corinthians 5:17, if anyone is in Christ, he's a new creation. Old things have passed away. Behold, all things have become new. God wants to take us from what we were and make us to what he wants us to be. And sometimes it's surprising when you see what some people have become and how they have changed. And we see them from their before salvation days till sometime afterwards, and we think, is this the same person? It's what God does. So God can take a weak man like Peter, just a piece of clay, and make him a rock. And he can take a doubter like Gideon and make him a general. Well, the third lesson we learn then is simply that God's plan always works the best. It always does. So verse 22 tells us what happened. When they blew the 300 trumpets, the Lord set the sword of one against another, even throughout the whole army, and the army fled. They were scared. It's dark. All of a sudden, all these torches are exposed. They're surrounded. They hear the 300 horns blowing. They hear shouts. And as far as they can tell in the darkness, they are attacked. They're surrounded. They're going to be defeated. And in all the confusion, God causes the Midianites to turn their swords on each other. They think they're fighting the enemy, but they're stabbing their fellow soldiers. And those that survived fled for the hills, and the Israelites chased them down. It was a great victory without raising a weapon. But it was just a demonstration that it was by God's strength and plan, not by human schemes or power. And I do believe that every Christian, every one of us, myself included, can learn from this. Vital lessons on trusting God for victory in anything. But I think the church in general can learn a great deal from this event and be encouraged by it. You see, what this proves to us is that God doesn't need large numbers to accomplish his purposes. Nor does he need leaders with great charisma, great ability. Gideon and his men were simply 300 common, simple people. People who were available to God. Now, I say this not trying to come across as judgmental in any way, but I think it's true. When a church begins to depend on its bigness, big buildings, big crowds, big budgets, big influence, I think there's a real risk there of developing misplaced faith. Faith becomes more in those things than it is in God Himself. And God can't really give His blessing. Now, again, I'm not saying every big church is like that. I know big churches that are great, and they're solid, and they're being used of God, and I'm thankful for them. But I also know that the majority of churches across this land are small churches, 100 or less. So it's when there's that attitude that the small church, God can't really use them, or they're kind of inconsequential to the whole work of God. It's the big church that's doing everything right. Maybe it's just their hipness. Maybe it's just they've got the ability to pull off better music. That's relative, I guess. Or they got all the programs. Well, I'm glad they do, and they can minister and meet needs that people have, but don't discount the small churches. God doesn't need the large numbers to do great things. He can use our church to do great things if we are surrendered to Him and we lay aside our fears and put aside our confidence in ourselves and our abilities, our programs, and just do His work and do what He calls us to do. We'll accomplish what He wants done. His plan always works the best. Or even when leaders depend on their education or their talent, their experience, their charisma, rather than depending on God and letting Him use them in their weakness, then God abandons them and looks for a Gideon. I think I'd rather be a Gideon. But I'd be more scared than he was. Well, let me just kind of wrap this up by making it personal. God knows the Midianites in your life. You know that? We all have them. We don't call them that, but just by way of illustration, we all have those Midianites in our lives. The things that are troubling us, the sins that are bugging us, the temptations or the people. Whatever it is that's bringing us down and leaving us discouraged or depressed or defeated. But God doesn't want us to battle these things on our own. Even though there are things that swirl around us and are out of our control, there is one inner reality that we have to remember. And that's the fact that God is enough. God is always enough. And I think this is why the Apostle Paul said in a verse I cited last week, you know, from Philippians, I can do all things. Whether sitting in a jail cell here or any other thing that life throws at me, I can do it all through Christ who strengthens me. I don't have to rely on my own strength. And so, if you don't know Jesus on that personal level, in the sense of salvation, the term we use, I think this is a word for you. And if you're being held back or you're struggling with these issues of life and you're doubting, you don't really know for sure if the whole gospel thing is enough. I just want you to know that God is enough, and that because He is enough, He is bigger than your problems. He is bigger than your failures. He's bigger than your regrets, how many they may be. He's bigger than your sin, bigger than your guilt. If you just open the door of your heart and let Him move in and change you, He will come in and be your forgiver. He'll be your strength. He'll be your Savior. And He'll also be your friend. And you'll fall more and more in love with Him as time goes on and you grow in your faith. Let's pray.